Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be talking about childbirth today and about an interesting rift of sorts which has sprung up over sort of warring impressions of what childbirth is meant to be or best is. And it is, in a sense, a struggle which is happening, in a sense, between the best that modern medicine has to offer and that movement which is sometimes known as natural parenting, which involves the possibility of natural childbirth in which little or no medical intervention as such is allowed. And that is built upon some assumptions, among them that natural is always better, and that by avoiding the involvement of the professional medical community and all that it has to offer, that somehow a person is likely to experience much more joy and satisfaction and greater meaning in the act of giving birth. And there are ways in which that perhaps can be believed to a certain extent, and sometimes, as is the contention of our guest on the morning show today, those assumptions can be taken way too far in a way that can lead to terrible harm to both mother and child. That is the contention of Dr. Amy Tuter, who is an obstetrician and gynecologist, already the author of a book called How Your Baby Is Born, and now the author of a new book called Pushback, Guilt in the Age of Natural Parenting, in which she seeks to set the record straight about some of these assumptions that she believes are erroneously made. And she hopes to leave people with a much more balanced approach to some of these very, very personal questions. The book is published by Day Street, an imprint of William Morrow. And Dr. Amy Tuter, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wanted, ahead of this interview, in addition to reading your book, which I have done, I wanted also to take a look at your blog, and time just got away from me this week. I'm intrigued by its title, The Skeptical OB. Can you just say a quick word about that blog and what it is about? Is it largely about the same subject matter that is dealt with in your book?
Yes, it is. The term skeptic does not mean somebody that is just skeptical of everything. In the world of science, a skeptic is somebody who demands proof. So I'm an obstetrician who believes you have to prove something to me in order for me to incorporate it into my medical practice or to advise patients about it. And I'm pretty skeptical about some of the claims of natural parenting, specifically the natural childbirth industry, the breastfeeding industry, and the attachment parenting industry.
You write this book and your blog not only as an obstetrician and gynecologist, but also as the mother of four children. I wonder if you could just say a word about to what extent that is a significant factor here, in the very strongly held beliefs that you have about this topic.
The fact that I have four children is certainly very important to the way I write, but I think the most important aspect of it is my children are grown, and so I've had an opportunity to see how these philosophies play out in real life. I've seen my children grow up, their friends grow up, and my friends' children. And a lot of the things that people say are so vitally important in the early days of parenting not make much difference at all in across the entire length and breadth of raising a child.
And we really should talk about the word guilt, which appears in the subtitle of the book. You say in the introduction, my goal with this book is to release women from the guilt trap that is created by the natural parenting industry. Tell our listeners more about this guilt trap and, in a sense, how that trap has been set.
Well, I think that there's no way to be a mother without avoiding guilt of some kind. You feel guilty for a lot of the decisions that you've made, and of course, guilt comes in very handy when you're trying to get your children to do things. So guilt is an integral part of motherhood, but there's really no reason that we need to add to it. And I think some of these movements by putting ever-increasing expectations on women and telling them that their children will turn out poorly if they don't fulfill those expectations, that ratchets up the guilt. I think there was a lot of guilt to go around when I was raising my children, but I'm really glad I did it then and not now, because it seems much, much worse.
I want to say one other thing about your particular perspective before we dig into a few details. Again, you are an obstetrician gynecologist, so you are speaking as a professional within the medical world, the conventional medical world, if we want to call it that. But you make mention of something in the introduction that I think is extremely important, namely that you have worked quite a lot with certified nurse midwives, and you obviously have had a largely positive experience with most of them. Say a word about that, about the extent to which you have had this experience in your practice, how positive it has been, and what that says about your perspective as we get into some of the criticisms that you want to level against the natural parenting field.
Well, I think one thing that's really important to make clear is that in the United States, unlike in other countries, there are actually two kinds of midwives here. And people often get confused. In fact, many people don't even realize that there are two kinds of midwives. There are real midwives, who are certified nurse midwives, who are the best educated, best trained midwives in the world. And then we have a group of women who call themselves certified professional midwives, who aren't really midwives at all. They would not meet the qualifications, the international midwifery qualifications that all other midwives in industrialized countries meet. Certified professional midwives are essentially lay people who couldn't be bothered or didn't want to get a real midwifery credential. And they try to piggyback off the great reputation of certified nurse midwives when they are something very, very different. So during the years that I practiced, I worked a lot with certified nurse midwives, and they were excellent. And their safety statistics in the scientific literature bear that out. But home birth midwives, who are certified professional midwives, I came across them in my practice and was very unimpressed. And the more I've learned about them and the death rates at their hands, the more concerned I've become that many women don't really understand the difference.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Amy Tuter, who is the author of a book called Push Back, Guilt in the Age of Natural Parenting. In this book, Dr. Tuter takes aim at what she feels are groundless claims made by at least certain segments of the natural parenting field. And she feels that many of these assumptions that are made or myths that are propagated, however you want to say it, really do a harm to women by, in a sense, sort of emotionally and mentally browbeating them into making decisions about their own bodies and the act of childbirth that could ultimately be detrimental to their own health or that of their baby. I really appreciate how you describe in part one of the book, which is titled Subverting the Science, you say some really moving words about what it means to be an obstetrician, which is, I think, a field that a lot of us don't fully appreciate in terms of the extraordinary joys that are involved as well as the shattering sadnesses that are also involved. Say a word about the work that you do and, in a sense, the emotional and mental toll that I'm sure it takes.
Well, I am retired now, but when I was practicing, I found it an incredible privilege to be part of so many women's lives at such an important moment. And that's the amazing thing about being an obstetrician. You're invited in at these intimate moments, and they're usually very, very happy. But the potential always exists for things to go wrong. I mean, that's why you have a birth attendant in the first place, because if we could be sure that everything was going to be fine, you could just give birth at home with your partner or whatever family members you wanted to invite. But the reason that all cultures have birth attendants and always have had birth attendants is because childbirth is dangerous. And so it's the obstetrician's job to remain fully aware of the dangers and do everything possible to prevent anything bad from happening.
You came to realize at some point how many women believe that childbirth is inherently safe, that a healthy baby is virtually guaranteed, that the worst thing that can happen is getting the wrong breakfast order. That comes from a story that you tell about somebody who experienced kind of a harrowing experience and nearly lost their baby, and maybe their own health was threatened, but came through, and the next morning all they could talk about was that the cafeteria got their breakfast order wrong.
Right.
To you, that sort of spoke to an assumption, an erroneous assumption, that that women and men, for that matter, sometimes make, not understanding the risk that is present. What is it about our modern world that, in a sense, has led to this misunderstanding or this assumption that childbirth, by and large, is without risk?
Well, I think that, in our country, we have the expression, that's history. And when we say it, we mean that's irrelevant. But history isn't really irrelevant, and we forget it at our own peril. I think the natural childbirth movement has some very uncomfortable parallels with the anti-vaccine movement, in that the anti-vaccine folks, they don't see vaccine-preventable diseases around and assume that they were never really much of a problem, and all this fuss about vaccines is overdoing it. And similarly, we see very little maternal and neonatal death now, and people make the assumption that it was always that way, when our own grandmothers and our great-grandmothers, were they still alive, could tell us that it was very, very different only 100 years ago.
You point to one of the reasons that some women have what you call unrealistic expectations of the birth process from a book called Childbirth Without Fear, published back in 1942. And you say this is widely viewed as the foundational document of the natural childbirth movement. Tell us about this book and who wrote it and under what circumstances it was written.
Well, it was written by Grant Lee Dick Reed, who was an obstetrician, and he's considered the father of the natural childbirth philosophy. But there's some interesting details that people tend to forget about him. Grant Lee Dick Reed was a eugenicist, and in the 30s, eugenicists were pretty upset about the possibility of what they called white race suicide, in that the white people of what they considered the better classes would be overrun by the black and brown people of what they considered the poorer classes. And so Grant Lee Dick Reed really wanted to encourage white women of the better classes to have more children. And he thought that one of the things that was holding them back was their fear of the pain of childbirth. And he came up with this theory, he just completely made it up, that the pain in of childbirth was all in women's heads, that they had been socialized to believe that childbirth was painful. And he actually went so far as to say that primitive women, by which he meant black women, didn't have pain in childbirth, and that was because they understood that their primary role in life was to give birth and raise children. So the fundamental belief of the natural childbirth movement that pain is a result of socialization was a gigantic lie made up to manipulate women.
Hmm.
And although the natural childbirth movement now considers itself a feminist movement, I don't think they realize that the origins were so deeply anti-feminist and that some of those things still persist in natural childbirth today.
Right. You quote this book at one point with these words, "The mother is the factory, and by education and care, she can be made more efficient in the art of motherhood." Those are rather chilling words to read. You also give very interesting background information about Lamaze, which most of us know something about, but I think hardly any of us know exactly its origins in post-war Soviet Union. And the reason why something called Lamaze, I mean eventually called Lamaze, was developed. Explain that to our listeners.
Well, Lamaze arose in the post-war Soviet Union. And it was another example of necessity being the mother of invention, because the Soviet Union had been nearly destroyed in the Second World War. And at the conclusion of the war, they didn't have enough money to buy anesthetics for surgery, let alone for childbirth. Yet they were deeply concerned about competing with the West, where a lot of women were very pleased about all the different kinds of pain relief you could get in childbirth. And so drawing on the work of Pavlov, who's a very famous Russian scientist, they decided that women could be conditioned to not feel the pain of labor. And they made up all these various breathing exercises. And there was just one problem with it, and that was that it didn't work. And Soviet women were really not very happy with it at all. And it's curious how it came to be called Lamaze, because it was imported into the French communist hospitals. The Communist Party in France ran its own hospitals, and Dr. Lamaze was one of the doctors. And they brought the technique over as an example of how Soviet science was superior to American science. Because American science, you had to have drugs to combat the pain of labor, and drugs are expensive, but Soviet science had created a weapon, not a weapon, a method whereby even the poorest women would have access to it, because all it was Pavlovian conditioning.
Hmm. You spend a fair amount of your book talking about the matter of pain, and the fact that there are many women who are, in one way or another, convinced that to acknowledge the pain of childbirth and to seek out some sort of remedy for it, like an epidural or whatever, is somehow a sign of weakness, of caving in, of surrender to something that can be surmounted in some other way. And among the ways you refute this is by just pointing out that when one simply looks at the human body, it is inescapable that childbirth is going to be, to at least some extent, a painful experience. And you say neither the mother nor the child in any way gain from that pain being experienced.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I mean, the pain of childbirth was so impressive to our ancestors that the people who wrote the Bible could only explain it as a punishment from God. So the idea that childbirth is painful was not something anybody had to socialize women to believe. They always thought it was painful, and around the world, all women think childbirth is painful. The idea that childbirth is better with the pain, that the pain is somehow, that it enhances the experience, That's a brand new idea, and that comes from the resurgence of midwifery and the growth of doulas and childbirth educators. Because the thing that you have to understand is that when a provider can't offer a certain kind of technique, there's a nearly irresistible urge to demonize it. So midwives and doulas can't offer epidurals, so they demonize them. And it's the same thing with C-sections. They demonize C-sections. They can't offer them. The idea that women should be empowered or enhanced by pain is really very misogynistic. And I often say that I'll believe when women are empowered by pain when men are empowered by passing a kidney stone without medication. You know, we would never suggest that things are better for men if they experience severe pain. We really should not suggest that for women, since it isn't true.
Hmm. You also call into question a notion that comes around the practice of C-sections, namely that sometimes statistics will be cited as being alarming, that the percentage of births that are done by C-section is somehow higher than some sort of optimal percentile that when we exceed that, there's obviously we're doing unnecessary C-sections. You caution us to be really, really careful about messing with those kind of statistics, and you call us to tie together statistics of C-sections with statistics of child mortality. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, you know, one of the problems with natural parenting movements in general is that they focus on process, not outcome. So they focus on how a baby is born, but not whether a baby survives birth. And I think a far more important metric for evaluating childbirth is how many babies survive and how many mothers survive. And C-sections have been critical in dramatically dropping the neonatal and maternal mortality rate. Now, our C-section rate in this country at the moment is above 30%. And I think everybody agrees that that rate is higher than it needs to be. But we have a very serious problem, and that is we can't tell in advance which are the necessary C-sections and which are the unnecessary ones. So it's kind of like breast biopsies. When somebody has a lump in her breast, you get the lump biopsied. 80% of the time it's not cancer, and that's great. But that doesn't mean those biopsies were unnecessary, because we had to be sure.
Right. In fact, you're pointing to something that's an interesting concept called the cascade of interventions, which apparently is also a concept held by many in the natural childbirth movement. What is the cascade of interventions, and how should we think about this?
Well, you know, as I said before, natural childbirth professionals can't offer a lot of things, and so they demonize those things. And the issue with the cascade of interventions is that if you do a test, you might find out that a woman needs one of those things that natural childbirth advocates can't offer. So they caution women not to have any tests, because according to them, one intervention leads to another, and the next thing you know, you're having a C-section. But while that is potentially what can happen, if you think about it in a different context, you realize how silly the cascade of interventions really is. Because imagine that your child says she has a sore throat. So you take your child's temperature, and it's elevated. And because it's elevated and your child is complaining, you take her to the doctor. And the doctor looks in her throat and does a throat culture, and it turns out that she has strep. And the doctor treats her with antibiotics. And as a result of the antibiotics, she has some diarrhea that goes away after she stops the antibiotics. Now, you could argue that taking a child's temperature begins the cascade of interventions. Because if you didn't know she had a temperature, you wouldn't have taken her to the doctor, and you wouldn't have found out about the need for antibiotics, and therefore she never would have got an upset stomach in the end. But the whole reason you did it is because strep throat has very serious complications. It's not the sore throat that's the problem. You know, she could get rheumatic fever and heart damage and so forth. So it's the same thing in obstetrics. You know, they say don't let the doctor monitor you during labor, because then they'll diagnose distress and then you'll have a C-section. Well, yes, but you might actually have distress and your baby's life might need to be saved. And if you don't check, then you won't know.
Hmm. Well, we have really barely scratched the surface of all that is in this book. You go on to talk about why this some of these beliefs took hold as they did, the way in which you view a lot of this as very sexist and quite anti-feminist, and offer some strategies in terms of helping people to reframe some of these concepts and assumptions that people make. Dr. Amy Tuter, the author of Pushback, Guilt in the Age of Natural Parenting. It is published by Day Street Books. The time is 8:36, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD. Here's part two of today's program. Perhaps you or someone you love has been touched by the scourge of cancer. One of the factors which can make what is already a frightening and certainly, to say the least, unpleasant situation even more so is the fact that often a cancer person undergoing treatment will lose their appetite or have their sense of appetite radically altered, and which can be certainly an unsettling situation. And of course, such matters can also mean that the nutritional intake of a cancer patient might be really adversely affected. A wonderful booklet has been put together now called Tell Me What to Eat Before, During, and After Cancer Treatment: Nutritional Guidelines for Patients and Their Loved Ones. This is written by Jody Buckman Weinstein, who is a registered dietitian and a board-certified specialist in oncology nutrition, and currently the clinical nutrition coordinator at the Tisch Cancer Institute at Mount Sinai Medical Center. She has worked with many, many cancer patients and has come to an understanding of some of the changes which a cancer patient can make in which they will continue to get the nutrition that they need, which is so vital for their well-being and, of course, ultimately, whatever recovery might be possible. And so we have her on the phone for the next few minutes to talk about this very important question and her book, again called Tell Me What to Eat Before, During, and After Cancer Treatment, which is published by Career Press. Jody Buckman Weinstein, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me.
How did you happen to find your way into what I assume is a relatively narrow field of specialty, that of being an oncology nutritionist?
Well, it started when I worked at Mount Sinai Medical Center, and I was asked to become their first dietitian in their cancer center. And I've been working with patients daily, so I come in contact with patients afflicted with cancer on a daily basis, and I watch them go through these nutritional issues all the time, and I really see what they go through, and it can be very, very difficult for them.
Now, did you start out as just sort of a general nutritionist who found her way into oncology, or first were you interested in cancer and then found the nutritional aspect of it especially interesting?
I worked in, you know, there's different fields of nutrition. There's people that work with weight loss primarily, or there's people that work in food service, and then there's clinical nutrition where you work in a hospital. So I was working at Mount Sinai Hospital. I was working on the inpatient floors with neurological patients, and then I started working with head and neck cancer patients. So, and then I just found that I really, really enjoy the clinical nutrition aspect of the nutrition field more than anything else. So, yeah, I definitely, that's how I came into it.
When we're talking about a cancer patient whose appetite and otherwise intake of food is altered, can we separate at all between the effect of the cancer itself versus the effect of the treatment which they're receiving for the cancer? I mean, we, I think, hear a lot about how, for instance, chemotherapy so often will radically alter and reduce our sense of appetite. But what about the cancer itself, even before we receive treatment? Is that also sometimes a factor in our nutrition, or in our nutrition being compromised, or our sense of appetite being compromised?
Yeah, there is, you know, cancer itself does something to people's metabolisms, and it kind of, you know, not for everyone, but for a lot of patients, it can cause an altered metabolism where they have a higher metabolism, and they're burning down calories faster. And they, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say that it causes a lower appetite, but it can make them burn more calories, which makes them have weight loss. So it could be that someone presents with weight loss when even before they know they have cancer. You know, that can be even one of the symptoms of cancer. Someone presents with weight loss. So that is definitely part of cancer itself. In terms of the treatments, you know, there's a whole wide range of side effects from treatments that affect appetite and that affect your eating. So it's a combination of both of those.
I had known about chemotherapy having such side effects. I didn't realize that even radiation treatment also can have such effect on us.
Yeah, absolutely. Depending on the region of the body where the radiation is, you know, affecting, it can cause lots of side effects. If it's to the head and neck area, it can cause difficulty swallowing. It can cause some mouth sores and dryness and thick saliva. You know, if it's in the abdominal area, some people have gastrointestinal issues like constipation or diarrhea. So it really, you know, depends on what area of the body it's affecting.
So your book lays out a lot of different important ideas for the cancer patient. And in particular, what I think will be of interest to people, because it might not ever occur to them, is that you have a whole section devoted to pre-treatment diet planning.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us why it's important, if possible, to be thinking about these matters even at that stage in the game.
Well, again, you know, a lot of patients present already with weight loss, so they're starting off a little bit, you know, undernourished. But even if somebody doesn't, even if they never lost weight, the pretreatment planning is really great for people to get a sense of what they should be doing before they're starting this. A lot of it is building up, you know. It's how to get enough nutrition before they start treatment to build up their strength. And it talks about just some tips of changing your eating habits, because I think people habitually eat a certain way. Either they're, you know, they constantly skip breakfast or they never snack, and people have a certain way of eating every day, and they need to sort of think about a different way of eating when they're going to go through cancer treatment, and their appetite may change and they might need to eat different foods. So, you know, I do discuss a lot about routine and getting into a habit of eating more frequently, and as opposed to eating 3 large meals a day, you know, focusing on more like 5 to 6 mini meals per day, and getting into this concept of small snacks throughout the day, because that's what really helps cancer patients when they're going through treatment and they don't have much of an appetite, to have snacks around and to eat more frequently and to not skip any meals.
One of the things you were saying is people should feel comfortable essentially eating whenever they're hungry.
Yes.
And of course, for a lot of people, that's not the way they live their normal lives when they are free of cancer, for instance. I mean, they really try to resist just popping something in your mouth at the first pang of hunger. But I suppose when you are about to and then are receiving treatment for cancer, the whole matter of hunger and appetite is going to fluctuate so wildly. And when you do feel any inclination to eat, you need to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I that's the number one thing I tell people, is that when you're hungry, you have to eat, you have to get into the routine, and you have to follow, you know, your hunger cues. But at the same time, many people have to also learn the opposite, how to eat when it's hard to tell someone that before it starts, but how to eat when they don't have hunger, because their hunger cues might not be there, and they still are going to have to eat. So they're going to have to eat small amounts, but, you know, eat it more frequently. So they have to, you know, get into that sort of idea also. So it is good to just have, you know, get food in the house, be prepared ahead of time, and start thinking that way.
You also mentioned focusing on comfort foods. and thinking about the kinds of foods that you would be comfortable eating even, you know, while battling the flu or something else, or just food that is easy to eat and feels good eating, and make sure you have plenty of it for this patch of time.
Exactly. You know, I think that people can always remember a time when they felt, you know, down in the dumps or under the weather, and they were sick with a cold or the flu, and or they have stomach issues, or somebody knows what they felt like when they vomited. And I think that, you know, those are the kind of foods that people should start thinking about, because that's a lot of times what patients report that they feel like, and they need to eat foods that are comforting. First and foremost, when someone's feeling not well, the comfort foods provide them with emotional comfort, and it just makes them feel better. So I tell people to go to that first when they're not feeling well. And if they're not feeling well, where their stomach's bothering them, I tell them to eat foods that they would eat after, you know, when they're nauseous and vomiting regular, you know, if they weren't afflicted with cancer. So I think people understand that.
What's so intriguing is that we'll come to a section in your book about diet during treatment, and it's all kinds of suggestions on ways to add calories to your diet.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we're talking so often about the scenario where someone has already lost weight and is at risk of losing far more and more than would be healthy. And so then we're reading suggestions like liberally add butter, margarine, oils, and gravies to rice, pasta, soups, cooked vegetables, mashed and baked potatoes. We have to sort of like shake our heads in wonder
right.
that we're reading this these suggestions from a nutritionist. But, of course, it just shows how cancer turns so much on its heads from our normal life.
That's exactly right. And I think that that is the number one hardest thing for people to grasp when I'm educating them verbally in person or reading it. Yeah, I think everyone kind of shakes their head. Wow, I can't believe this. But the truth is that if weight loss is an issue, it is the number one priority to prevent extreme weight loss, because weight loss has been shown to cause a decreased quality of life, treatment breaks, and we really don't want to have a tremendous amount of weight loss. So it is the number one priority. And I tell people to think of it as it's a temporary fix. This isn't that we're suggesting these kinds of foods, these high calorie foods, for 50 years. You know, this is something that you're going through a hard time in your life right now. It's a challenging time, and temporarily this is what you need to do to prevent weight loss, and that's the priority. So, you know, in the end chapters of the book, you know, we talk about survivorship when someone's out of treatment and they're doing well and they're at a healthy weight, that it is back to the healthy eating. But, you know, sort of during treatment, we just do basically whatever it takes to keep their weight on.
One issue which people undergoing treatment for cancer often face is a change in how their mouth feels. And sometimes there is this thing called dry mouth syndrome and other matters related to the mouth. I mean, that cavity in which things change, and that can really adversely affect our interest in eating or our ease in eating. First of all, describe a little further for our listeners what I'm talking about. How common a problem it is, and from a nutritional point of view, what one can do about that.
You know, there's something that goes on in the mouth where patients describe it's very dry. It can get very dry, you know, and they need to constantly drink, and they can become dehydrated. But it's also this poor taste, and every patient describes it to me differently. You know, I'll hear food tastes like cardboard, it tastes like metal, it tastes like chalk. All these different descriptions have been, you know, told to me by patients. And, you know, foods that somebody once loved, they no longer love anymore. It tastes different. And foods that they've never tried before, they're trying and they're having a taste for it. So it is sort of a trial and error period for many, many patients. They have to, you know, try out a food and see how it tastes. And depending on the taste of it, you know, they're going to see maybe they prefer more sweet, or maybe they prefer more salty, or maybe they prefer more sour or tart. So, you know, they have to figure out which of their taste buds are working for them at the time.
One interesting list involved the safety of one's food, of being careful with how foods are prepared. It's a list called Food Safety Guidelines, and it talks about how much you should be washing your hands before and after you handle your food, where it's stored, how you handle your utensils, and so on. This was intriguing to me because as I read these suggestions, a lot of them looked like they probably make sense for all of us to follow.
Yes,
and yet, but I'm assuming that these guidelines are maybe even a bit more stringent because the matter of handling food safely is of supreme importance for a cancer patient.
Absolutely. I mean, majority of those guidelines should be followed by the general public. They're general food safety guidelines. There are, you know, some stricter ones when someone's immune system is compromised. But for the most part, the food handling and the food safety, those are all for the general public as well. And washing your hands and keeping your cutting boards clean and, you know, throwing foods out when they're spoiled. Those are general food safety guidelines. So that's correct. Yeah.
Hmm. Ultimately, your book also includes such suggestions all the way down to suggestions for meals, menu ideas, and even a few recipes here and there. That may kind of come as a surprise to people that advice needs to be delivered even down to that kind of nitty-gritty level. But what kind of mistakes are you trying to help people avoid in giving even that kind of information in your book?
Well, first of all, giving suggestions, people like to know exact foods. I get it all the time, patients saying, tell me exactly what to eat. You know, just like the book says, tell me what to eat. People really say that all the time. They want to know not just ideas, but, you know, general ideas. They want to know exact foods. So, you know, it guides people, especially when someone's appetite is down. It's hard to think of food, and it's hard to even explain this to other people who are eating normally. But I get it all the time. They can't even think of foods to eat because their appetite is so diminished. So it helps give them ideas and maybe change things around within the menus. And it also helps people, you know, see what a high-calorie or high-protein balanced diet looks like. Even though there's a list of suggestions, it gives them, you know, it gives them more detailed suggestions. And many people eat lower-calorie things, and they think they're eating great. You know, I'll meet someone that's lost 10 pounds, and I review their diet with them, and they're eating loads and loads of lower-calorie foods and lots of vegetables and you know, lots of fruits and low-fat items, and they're not eating, you know, they're eating only two meals a day, and they don't have any, you know, I haven't talked to them yet, and they don't understand the concept of higher-calorie foods and eating more frequently. So I think that sometimes people think that just because they're eating food, it really depends on what the food is that they're eating.
Hmm. Is it possible to go too far in that direction or to do it in a way that is ultimately counterproductive? I mean, there are high-calorie foods and then there are high-calorie mm-hmm. foods. I mean, gigantic burgers piled with bacon and so on.
Right.
But in the end, when a patient is battling cancer and this situation with their nutrition and perhaps their weight loss, is it such an important concern that in the end what matters the most are the pounds, keeping on the pounds?
That's a good question. You know, it's not that we're recommending, you know, to eat loads and loads of cheeseburgers. You know, that's why I do try to give the examples of balanced meals where there is, you know, complex carbohydrates, there's protein, and there's fat. And those are the main three nutrients, which I discussed earlier in the book, and I sort of try to tell people about the nutrients so they understand what is a complex carb and what is a protein and what is a fat, and getting those in balance with each other. And while, you know, other foods that are high in saturated fat and high in sugar, you know, we're not recommending those, you know, as the primary source of energy for people to eat, but it can be more liberally in the diet than the general population that we're trying to tell them to avoid those types of foods generally. So, you know, just getting, you know, making sure that they're eating a balance of the healthier one, healthy fats, for example, avocados, that has lots of fat, but it's the healthier fats. I tell patients to eat nuts, which are a high-calorie food, but are healthier. So I do, you know, I tell them to use olive oil, if they can more often. But we definitely try to tell them, you know, the pounds are what matters. If you feel like eating whatever it is that day, go for it. But we definitely don't suggest loading up on only, you know, hamburgers all day long. You know, we do try to suggest them to have a balance.
One thing I found quite interesting after the chapter, which is about life after treatment, in which, of course, you hope people can find ways to kind of alter things back and achieve some normalcy once again, is a section then about various nutrition resources available to people. And one thing you ask, or a question that to which you respond, is how can I spot diet quackery? Could you just say a moment about some of what is out there that people need to be really wary of, and some of the scams even that could ultimately lead people down very, very counterproductive paths?
Yeah, I probably get this question almost every day. People read tons of things on the internet, and they hear from their friends, mother's brother, what they read on the internet and what they read in a book. And there are so many people trying to sell products, and they're trying to market themselves. So, you know, there's so many diets out there where they'll say, this cures cancer, this, you know, can help you get through cancer treatment. And oftentimes it's not by anybody reliable. It's not a reputable source. And oftentimes it can be things that can actually be counteractive to the chemotherapy treatment. There are supplements out there that can actually make chemotherapy not work as well. So there is a risk, and it's very important to look at the source of where you're getting your information from and making sure that it's from a reputable source. So I give a list of many, many, many reputable sources that have a ton of nutrition information that answer common questions, and make sure that people don't, you know, fall into the quackery. And you know, people are looking for anything to cure them, and they're looking for things to make them feel better, and I understand that. And we all understand what, you know, what it would be like to look at nutrition as something that could possibly help them. But by the same token, many people can actually do the opposite. So it is important to make sure that they know where the source of the information is coming from.
By the way, could you just say a word about typically how you work with the patients that you see at Mount Sinai? I mean, when people come to you, or when you are working with them, typically what is that interaction like?
Typically, it is usually when they are going through chemo. They're getting an infusion, or they're getting hydration, and they're coming in, and I go and speak to them. I ask them, you know, how they're eating and how they're doing and how their side effects are treating them and what seems to be the primary side effect that is the worst for them at the time. It could be a few. You know, some patients have a few things affecting their eating and they're having weight loss. Or I'll meet with a patient when they're meeting with their doctor. They go and have an appointment with their doctor, and the doctor calls me in and says, this person needs some, you know, assistance from you. So it can be either when they're getting an infusion or when they're coming in for a doctor appointment. Patients can ask for their registered dietitian at their cancer center. Most cancer centers have a registered dietitian on staff, so they could ask for it if one wasn't, you know, offered to them. But it you know, I meet with people, and their family members are sitting by their side, and everybody usually wants to know what they can do to help and what kind of food they can bring over to the house and help the patient out. So I meet with sometimes entire families.
And that's a nice reminder for me to remind our listeners that part of the subtitle of this book reminds us that that this is a book not intended only for a cancer patient to read, but for their loved ones to read, for their family, even for their friends. So when you have a friend who is contending with cancer and you want to try to be of some help to them, this can be really, really helpful.
Absolutely. You know, the loved ones are the people that, you know, are able to bring the food. If someone's weak or they're not feeling well, they're not up to shopping. So the guidelines are really good for the loved one. They can offer assistance with knowing what they can buy for them or bring for them or cook for them.